highways. Stay in your homes. Stay in your homes.
Live from the Forbidden Book Group studio in Doppeltown, USA, it's Necronomapa with your host, Mike Sopla and Mike Moncada, episode 111, William Sloan's The Edge of Running Water. The story of a man who runs along the edge of some running water and a somewhat underage woman who loves him. And now, Necronomapa.
Military orders are subject to summary execution. Stay in your homes. Repeat, Comrade Channel. This is a Class 1 emergency. All civilian traffic is barred from streets and highways.
Okay.
Hello.
Howdy.
All right, so here we are, the second book of the of our William Sloan series.
Yes.
The Edge of Running Water.
Yes.
This one was a mystery.
It was a supernatural mystery.
Yeah, it was like a supernatural whodunit. Which I don't really go for.
Really?
I don't. No, it's just not my genre. I don't really like standard whodunits. This is pretty like, you know, theater of the airwaves, whodunit, narrative. That said, it has a good payoff.
Oh, you think so?
The payoff was pretty good. Yeah.
Hmm.
But this was way slower than the first book.
Oh, the tedium.
I know.
It was a very slow running river.
Yes, very slow running river.
Mostly marshy and
swampy,
gummy
sloughs, lots of leeches, blackbirds. Anyway, it was a bit of a grind. But I had the sense, as I was reading through it, that I was being given all the information that I needed, as I needed it, and that there was going to be a decent payoff. It's one of the reasons I don't like whodunits, is because it's all this build up towards the big scene, this book is that, and it does it really well. It's just I don't particularly like that aspect of that genre. So it did a really good job of not pleasing me. And so what are we drinking? No.
You weren't pleased. I have to say, I
was not displeased.
I was going to be really contrary and say I was so pleased about this. But I do have to say the payoff was
it was okay.
I wished more would have happened.
I think it was a pretty decent payoff for the day and age.
Right. Well, it was 1938,
30 somethings. Yeah, in the 30s sometime. So I finished the book, so we're reading this edition that just came out with a new introduction by Stephen King, and so I finally got around to reading the introduction, and Stephen King, God bless his dirty soul. Actually offered lots of really useful and helpful context. And in the light that he's shown on the book and the first book as well, it seemed like a better book to me.
Okay, address the...
I address this issue?
Can you address the context that he provides?
Well, he talks about, and I guess I wasn't aware of this, I guess I was sort of dimly aware of this, but he talks about that what William Sloan is writing in these two novels... his only two is essentially they're just weird tales. I mean, he blends in a little bit of Dashiell Hammett, hard boiled stuff, and
a little romance,
and this East Coast academic novel. I mean, both of these books are about scholars, are about academics.
Yeah.
So he's writing in this milieu that was very pulpy. Very pulpy, and a lot of the stuff that was published back then is basically unreadable. Even the stuff that people still remember who the authors are, like Clark Ashton Smith or Robert Howard or even H.P. Lovecraft, their style is execrable. I mean, it's pretty bad. This guy can write a damn sentence, and he can plot a book. There's nothing wasted in this book. I mean, maybe by somebody's taste.
Except for time.
except for my time. But it's fairly tightly plotted. The sentence by sentence, paragraph by paragraph, chapter by chapter structure is rock solid. And that is not something you could possibly hope for.
But what you don't really get is characters. You get types.
You get types.
Character types, but you don't get characters, even though you're in the head of one person.
Yeah.
And you kind of get him, but
a little bit. I mean, yeah, he's sort of in the first book, there's the two boozy young academic, or actually no, they were boozy young, like, I don't know where they were in Wall Street or something.
Yeah.
And in this one, you have
advertising or something.
Yeah, and here you have the associate professor going to visit his former major professor, and you have the plucky young girl.
Right, she's definitely a type. You can see it. Sandra Dee playing her or something.
Yeah, I guess the difference is, he may be writing types, but so frequently what you get in other weird tales is stereotypes, and often very negative ones. Although I have to say, Maine backwoodsers do not come off well in this book.
No. No, which I thought is interesting that Stephen King would gravitate towards that, because it was
So I'm reading this introduction. I'm like, when is he going to talk about the fact that the second book takes place in Maine? Because he's got very definite opinions about Maine, and he doesn't touch on it. He doesn't address it at all, because the caricature is quite broad.
Right.
So
those insular towns where they're.
Although the town that this takes place in is called Barsham Harbor, I think it's probably just supposed to be Bar Harbor.
Well, I'm sure.
Yeah. So like.
Well, but it was 30s, a really small town, though.
Yeah. In the 30s, maybe Bar Harbor was pretty small.
Is that the same as Bahaba?
It's also known as Bahaba. Yeah. So this book reminded me of one of my favorite books of all time.
Which is?
Frankenstein.
Yeah, it did have that.
Well, the main...
It did have that idea of it, of exploring things that shouldn't left be unexplored.
Yeah, and of sciencing the hell out of your grief.
Right.
Yeah, that's what he's doing.
Right.
That's what Victor Frankenstein does.
And what you don't ever know in this book is, does he ever... We don't even really know what this thing is.
No.
And we don't even know if it has anything to do with reaching his...
He's broken through to something.
He's broken through to something, and... He's trying to get it to his wife, but you never know, and there's no sense that you're in that realm at all. You could be in something completely different.
That's right.
It's never explained, and
he doesn't get any communications or anything like that. All he does is he opens up this vacuum into another dimension, another place, and when it closes, it sucks all the air out and causes that tremendous thunderclap.
Right.
So when it you
messes
finally,
up the furniture.
And it messes up the furniture and once in a while kills the house lady, the housekeeper.
Who I liked the best.
Who's the second most likable character.
Right.
Yeah. The third most likable character?
Was the plucky...
The stenographer who's really the brains behind
you liked her, huh?
And the most plucky is, of course, Anne.
Anne.
She's awful plucky.
And the worst...
She's also Jim Crack.
Mrs. Walters.
Yes. The medium. Oh. she was actually a pretty great villain.
She was awful.
She was really awful. Because she was really smart.
Really smart, really fat, and I'm picturing really tiny feet.
Tiny feet.
And she's a really good swimmer.
Yeah, you can see
that's funny.
Yeah. So
quite a stretch.
So I thought I had figured out how she had So much of the plot turns.
I pretty
around.
Much knew right away.
Well, I didn't know exactly how she, because there's all this business about the footprints.
Right.
So anyway,
I figured she put the shoes on.
Yeah, she put the shoes on. Yeah. But I thought she had just she'd walked out there, with the body.
Dragging the feet, picking up the feet, and making footprints.
No, and then walked out there again with the other shoes.
Right.
So you had the two sets of footprints. And then messed them all up, and then walked to the
river's edge.
To the river's edge, and then switched shoes and just threw her in. But then I wasn't quite sure how she like got back without causing footprints.
She's a really good swimmer.
Well, the reason was that she just jumped in and swam. Yeah,
that was the one contrivance that.
Yeah. So that was a little. I mean, that was kind of how
and how it made the plot.
It's how you drive these the whodunit kinds of plots, because you should be able to figure it out.
Yes,
and I probably should have myself.
I pretty much figured it out the minute she was laying on the ground. The woman was laying on the ground. Like, well, she's dead.
Yeah, she's dead, of course.
And then probably something happened with the experiment. Yeah. And
although I wasn't quite sure exactly what had happened, because I thought maybe like she had actually fallen down the.
She got possessed by a spirit and then fell down the stairs.
That would have been even more interesting.
Sort of
like Exorcist. I don't know. I have to say, at the end,
because spirits are really horrible walkers. They're really klutzy.
Very klutzy. I have to say, the way it worked out with this, you're left with nothing but the mystery of what the hell did he open up?
Yeah, you really don't know.
You don't know. That's the edition that we have here of these two novels. They're called Two Tales of Cosmic Horror. It's the not knowing. I think that's what they call cosmic here.
Okay, but here's the major plot hole.
Uh-huh.
And he addresses it, Richard, right? He addresses it, but he could have solved the problem.
Uh-huh.
Because he says to the sheriff, cut the power to the building.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And the sheriff says, well, I can't do that. For some stupid reason.
Okay, I'm not going to go around damaging property.
Right. Well, why couldn't he have gone into the basement and then taken out the fuses? Problem solved.
Problem solved. Well, I wonder.
Did they not have fuses back then?
They might not have.
Oh, really?
This is early. Because the town itself wasn't particularly wired.
No, it wasn't wired.
So he had to get like power cables run out special.
But don't you have to have fuses to regulate the power?
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm like, dude, go downstairs.
Yeah, just
flip the breakers. Yeah. Take out the fuses.
Yeah, unscrew the fuses. Knock the pennies out with a hammer.
The pennies. He didn't hear me.
He didn't hear you.
No.
No. Well, our narrator, Richard, aka Dick, was
a horny little devil.
He was always about a minute too late figuring things out.
He was.
Time and time again.
Well, I mean, this was totally new territory.
Yeah, he had no idea what this guy was working on.
I think what was funny in this book was how William Sloan, I won't be able to say it verbatim, but there was a scene where, you know, she's very grateful to me and I showed my appreciation and then I showed it again. And you're like, well, did he kiss her or did he fuck her or what did he do? And it's so 1930s.
It's cosmic horror. It's you don't big, know.
And it's so 1930s, right? Like, you know, fade to black.
Yes. Where's the fade out?
And right. She showed her appreciation.
And then she showed it again.
And then I showed it again. I showed my appreciation. And then I showed it again.
Yes, brown indeed.
Chicken, brown.
Yeah, brown chicken, brown cow. Anyway, I was actually sort of moved by Julian's predicament. He was so ill-equipped to deal with his emotions, to fall in love in the first place with his dear departed Helen, and then when he finally thaws, you know, unfreezes and lets love into his life, she's taken from him by what, pneumonia or something, flu.
Yeah, but she's already married.
Yeah, but they were married. Yeah, and then his grief, he goes back to the only thing he knows,
which is science.
He just refuses to. You know, he's got to see her again. He's got to communicate with her again. He's got to prove that there's an afterlife.
Right.
His existential pain is it's familiar, but it wasn't familiar for him. And the way he deals with it is it's touching.
Oh.
I thought so. Huh. I mean, and Julian, the only Julian
you but get Julian, to see. But Julian, you don't really get to know
you
him.
You don't. You just get to see what's left of him.
Yeah, he's kind of a shell. And he's driven. He's so driven.
Yeah, it's his ambition and his grief have just drained him. And it's sad. He's a sad dude.
Yeah, and what's really sad is he gets sucked up in this vortex, and who the hell knows where he went?
It's possible he got what he wanted.
Or he's dead.
Or both.
Or he got eaten by a monster. Or he's living on Mars or something.
Or he's living on Mars.
Yeah.
Or his body's just twisting out between the galaxies.
But the guy, but Richard, the feeling that he got from that vortex was not a good one.
Not a good one. And he surmised, because he's not a physicist.
He's a psychologist. He's
a psychologist. He surmised that, he's just been, every time he turns the machine on. So let's talk about what this machine is.
Yeah, this machine is interesting.
This machine is pretty cool.
It's pretty interesting.
So
he sets up a seance, basically, but he uses these constructed participants out of wire that look like people.
Yeah, electronic seance.
And they're in a circle, and they're touching, and...
Yeah, because back in the turn of the century, and even as late as the 30s, there were serious spiritualism. Yeah, the spiritualists. There was sort of a scientific, pseudo-scientific rigor about the whole thing.
Well, that was the thing with spirit, because there's spiritualism and there's spiritism.
Okay.
And the thing with spiritism, and probably spiritualism, is that they thought they were being scientists, that they could actually prove that these things were real by these manifestations, that they were...
Mm-hmm.
That they were actual verifiable data.
Yes.
That the afterlife exists because a tambourine floated or ectoplasm is a substance.
Yeah, yeah, and where those knocks come from.
Yeah, they thought they were being scientific.
Yeah. And so that's what William Sloan and therefore Julian here is latching onto. Is like, well, let's really science this. Apply. And then there's a lot of hand waving between... And he comes up, he's like, well, you know...
Yeah, what are the constants and...
Yeah, it's like, well, this is like, let me try to recreate this soft, this squishy thing that is a seance. So we have a table, we have people standing around it holding hands, and they're directing mental energy. So let's
and what's mental energy? It's electronic energy.
So he works that problem. He ends up with this simulacrum, this electronic simulacrum of a seance table. And there's a lever that you can crank it up higher or lower. And he's never cranked it all the way up. And it's Richard who thinks, if he cranks that thing all the way up, he's going to crack a hole
in reality
that we're not going to be able to close.
Right.
And that's the big risk. That's why everybody has to get out of the house. And, so how do they finally finish it up? Do they actually knock down a pole? I was reading so fast by the end there.
No, I think what happens is that it opens up and then it just sucks him in and it closes up.
Oh, yeah, you're right. It sucks in the, it drags the apparatus in after it.
It drags in the apparatus and then it drags in
Julian.
Julian, and then rearranges the furniture and then that's it.
Yeah, it just leaves like a couple of dismembered bodies, which were the simulacra.
Right.
Laying around.
You like saying that word simulacra.
I do. And then I also like saying Oberon.
I like saying Salmonex.
The house burns down and
it kind of burns down.
Yeah,
it mostly just collapses.
Yeah, like the fall of the House of Usher.
Yeah, because he goes in there and he can see that. Yeah. Oh, where's Julian? Mm-hmm. Isn't that here?
Nothing that resembles any part of him is here. That's no good.
And then Mrs. Walters hightails it out of there. We never hear from her again.
Yeah, she's
in the sequel.
Yeah, she jumps into the river and swims away. Or does she?
It's funny because we thought, you and I both thought that everyone was dead at the beginning of the story, the way he was telling the story.
Yeah.
Right? Didn't you think that everyone was dead?
Because
you said, well, the girlfriend's dead.
Oh, no. Well, he talks about his dead wife.
Oh.
But you were, that's neither here nor there. You were a couple chapters ahead of me, and you were speaking of something that I didn't know yet, and I assumed it was something that I did know.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyway, you know,
and then he gave it to her again.
Yes, that was clearly it.
Is that what they called your penis back in the 30s? My gratitude?
My gratitude.
Let me give you my gratitude.
That's actually a really excellent euphemism. Thanks.
Did I just make it up?
Thanks for bringing me that peach cobbler. Let me give you my gratitude. That's what the peach cobbler is for. Anyway, so I'm glad we read these two novels. I wish the guy had written more. So
when I don't know. I think he'd had enough.
Well, I think he's his. So you've read the introduction, right?
No.
By Stephen King. So this guy was, you know, he's East Coast educated, probably like a, I think he's like a Yale guy, maybe a Princeton guy, which explains why he can write a decent sentence, because that you had to learn for sure. He started off writing these short little plays. He had a bunch of one acts, like four or five of them, and then started working for publishing houses and eventually landed at Rutgers University Press, which still is a concern. And it's a really excellent and big university press. Puts out great, really good books. And he was the director of the press for like 20, 30 years until, I want to say, the mid-70s. And when you're a director of a press, you don't have time to be writing any more books. But one thing he did do is he was one of the instructors at the Breadloaf Writing Workshop, which is sort of a, I think it still goes on, but it's sort of a precursor to like the Iowa Writers Workshop.
Right.
So, you know, these big, you know, you come and you work for a month or a couple weeks with named writers and work on your craft. And he was an instructor there and a good one. Eventually, I think after he actually, either late in his career or even after he passed, maybe his daughter edited together a bunch of his lectures and published it as, you know, The Art of Writing or The Craft of Writing or something like that. And it's supposed to be a pretty good book. So he's one of these guys. He worked as a writer, but not writing. He was working with writers. He was editing them. He was acquiring them. He was teaching them. He just wasn't actually making any of his own books anymore.
Well, I definitely think the first book was better than the second book.
I agree.
I thought the first book had that foreboding
and
dread. And this book was, well, it's hard to say, you know, because in a way, it's whenever we read something that's old, you go, well, we've been down this path before. Had they been down this path before? I don't know.
Yeah.
I kind of think probably a little bit.
Yeah.
It didn't. I kind of had to figure it out pretty early, I guess, I have to say. And then the payoff to me was not that great. It was almost like the payoff that happens behind a curtain where you go, you can hear somebody screaming, but then you open up the curtain, you're like, well, what just happened here?
Yeah.
And so, you know, now if everybody had been killed, that would have been awesome. Or everybody gets possessed with demons or something, but that didn't happen. So it was very, the payoff was not, the time you put into the book to get to the payoff, and the payoff was like, well, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's instead of like a, instead of like when you read a novel, you expect like a banquet of courses. You want. You know, little climaxes all along the way.
Wow. You want gratitude. You want somebody to give you some
little
gratitude.
Bit of gratitude all along the way. And with a short story, you want that one moment. And what we have here is a novel with that one moment.
Yeah, it's kind of like a short story.
It's like a short story.
It wasn't a huge novel. It must be like a novella, right?
No, I mean, you know, it's a short novel. You know, like, what would it be like?
It was 28 chapters.
Yeah,
27 chapters.
Yeah, so it's like 180 pages, like of your standard paperback. It's a shortish novel.
But what I wonder though is if we have any insight into William Sloane's beliefs about things.
No, I mean
we don't. Because remember when we were reading? Who were we reading? Where you can kind of get a sense of what's his name? Richard Matheson, right?
Oh, yeah.
You can kind of get a sense of, he has this through line of belief about things.
Yes.
About the afterlife or about phenomenon.
Yeah.
And you kind of go with William Sloane, it's kind of this, is there a through line here in his work? Because we are reading multiple works. So yeah. What are the commonalities?
And yeah. Well, the only commonality is this glimpse that the characters get into the incomprehensible, the cosmic, the existence beyond human understanding.
There is an other of
that. That there's something out there that we can't grasp yet.
Yeah. So, like in the first book, we get this something inhabiting this body of this girl, but yeah. We don't really know what it is.
No. No.
And it's never really explained. It's just not up here.
Yes, not up here. And then it goes away.
Get this, like, sort of this hole in the universe, in this room, and the only phenomenon really is it's like a giant sucking machine, and it creates noise, and that's it. And you don't really know what it is. It could just be a vacuum, and that's it.
Yeah.
You know?
So as much as our sample is just these two novels so far, that's kind of it. And there's also he writes about the world that he knows, which is upper class, upper middle class, professionals, college educated, like Ivy League educated, professionals who enjoy a glass of scotch and a young woman,
but what you get the glimpse from those characters is very like. He really sees that world as kind of shallow.
Yeah, no.
And
because he has to do is refer to this world. He has this of their world. He just has this shorthand. He says, you know, this is not like this in the city.
Right.
That's all he says, the city. And everybody's supposed to know what that means.
Right.
But we don't ever see the city. We see the campus. We see the small town. We see the desert.
But we also get these men who don't really... You know, we get Julian, who's so caught up in his grief, he's sort of missing everybody around him.
Yeah.
And he's this disconnected person. I mean, he's always been disconnected.
Yeah.
Right? So you got this disconnected person who kind of lives in his mind, and then when he actually gets a freaking emotion, he doesn't know what to do with it.
Yeah, right? He really doesn't.
And then you get Richard, who, is in love with somebody who is never going to be his, and then... He falls in love with her younger sister. And he's constantly, wondering, is this right? Or so he gets a feeling he doesn't know what to do with it.
I used to take her out for Maltids.
Right. and you kind of knew from the get-go, it's like, well, he's going to get in her pants at some
Absolutely.
Point.
Absolutely. He's going to show his appreciation.
And then the two guys in the first novel are also sort of, they're disconnected of their love for each other. They're kind of clueless, and they don't know how to handle things very well.
Sure.
The one guy drinks himself into stupors all the time, and the other guy gets caught up in his work. So these are like people who are very disconnected from life and from the people around them, and they kind of glom onto superficial things. And I'm probably reading much more into it than they even deserve, but sort of gives you a view of this. Of Williamson definitely sees this world as there's something, the world that he writes of the people, that there's something kind of disconnected and superficial.
Interesting.
And then when they actually get life actually happens to them, they just don't know what to do with it.
So it's like I was trying to think of in like 20 years later, if he wrote about these characters' lives without the supernatural stuff, it'd be like a John Cheever stories or John Updike.
Right.
These people who,
or even J.K. Rowling's her novels that she wrote that weren't Harry Potter novels. Oh. These kind of dire and dour and people trying to deal with a situation. And
I haven't read any of those.
Yeah,
wow,
they're difficult. Oh. They're very depressing.
Nice.
Yeah.
Good for her. Yeah. She's J.K. Rowling. She can fucking write anything she wants now.
That bitch can write whatever she wants. She can just write on a tube of toilet paper and get published. Yep. But so you get, and then you get the sense that, does the that other that's out there sort of mirror these what these characters are in, which is really sort of a void.
Yeah.
They're in a void, and then they just open up into a void, and it seems much more interesting to them than the life that they're already in.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Uh-huh.
That's Julian. He can't see the life that he's already in. He has to go somewhere else, and it's a void. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Like, well, what's so attractive about that, I wonder?
You are reading deep into this. I'm very impressed.
A writer can write, you know, I'm going to write something fun or whatever, but I got to believe, I mean, his next play is about a ghost. He's got some interest in it. So what is it about the vehicle that, what is he trying to say about light? What is he trying to say about light,
yeah.
You know?
I mean, I'm really curious about his life because, you know, he worked in academic publishing. He taught mainstream literary writers. And he published these bunch of these plays, most of which were had some sort of supernatural element to them. He wrote these two novels, which are supernatural and mixed with other stuff. Yeah, yeah. And he edited a couple of collections of sci-fi. In fact, one of his collections is available at the local Doubletown Library, called Space, Space, Space.
Hmm.
We won't be. That.
Sounds like a fun nightclub.
Yes. and then he taught writing, and had a long and successful career.
But he is trying to say something about life. I mean,
yeah. But when he's
supernatural is a metaphor for something, right?
Yeah. So when he's writing, he's into the supernatural, into this genre, and
nothing good happens, right? So is he saying? You know, don't put your energy there, because there's nothing much worth.
Yeah,
nothing good that's going to come of that. That's what you hear Richard saying to Julian all the time. Why even go? I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but yeah. Why even go there? Why even do this? There's nothing good's going to come of this.
Yeah, you need to go back and live your life.
Right. Go back and live your life.
Yeah, and that lesson that humans aren't supposed to know certain things. Is fairly antithetical to most of the sci-fi that was being written at the time.
Hmm.
Because back then, sci-fi, which came out of the guy who sort of coined the name, Hugo Gernsback, he was very positive about technology. Keep finding out. Keep experimenting. It's all going to get better. It was very positive. And all those, the boy genius... like the Tom Swift novels where Tom Swift invents this and solves crimes or the Buck Rogers, the early space operas, all technology almost always was used for good, or to stop people using technology for bad. And it always worked. You know, I always were able to stop the bad guys. It was never the case that finding things out was opening a bottle of, and letting out a genie that you couldn't get back in.
I think the finding things out is fine, but I think what he's saying, if you're finding things out and you're disengaged from the life around you, that's where you're screwed up.
Yeah.
Because in that first book, right, he leaves everything and goes to this, disconnects and goes to this place in New Mexico or whatever, and just disengages from everything. He gets lost in his work.
Yeah.
And that professor who dies in that book is lost in his work.
Yep.
And then the Julian is lost in his work.
Yeah,
and
it's funny. It's
about academics being
it's lost
in their work.
It's as if in these both of these novels are the first like 50 pages of Frankenstein, where Victor loses his mother.
I think it was his brother.
His brother loses a family member, and goes into grief, and he decides, fuck you, death, I'm going to conquer you using science. Mm-hmm. And he goes away, he withdraws from all of his contacts.
Yeah.
And withdraws off up to a mountaintop somewhere, and he does it. He sciences the hell out of it, and he solves it. Yeah. Creates his monster.
Yeah.
That it's where both of these books end.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas in Frankenstein, he realizes what, you know, this is insane. I need to go back and live my life, marry my half sister. But then it's too late.
Right. Because what you created is now there and has to be dealt with.
So, I mean, that makes these books more interesting because there's sort of that meditation on that impulse that drives the first part of Frankenstein.
It's emotions not being handled.
it's emotions driving research, driving science.
But it's very human, right?
But it's very human.
You're not dealing with the thing at hand, so you go and get married again. And you married exactly the person you just divorced.
Yeah.
Right? Or
the exact opposite, which can be worse.
Right. Well, it's always the same, different side of the same coin. So
it's always a different side of the same, always the same coin.
So speaking of coins, isn't it time for cocktail time?
I believe it is. All right.
Wait.
Here we go. So this was a little complicated.
We thought really hard about how we were going to make this drink.
So let's give the title first, the name of the drink. We're going to call this
The River's Edge.
The River's Edge. We started off with the idea to mess with a mojito.
Right.
So this is going to be a very un-mojito mojito, but it gives you sort of the idea. So take a tall, like Tom Collins glass.
Yes.
And
you probably want something not a Tom Collins glass.
You want something.
You want like a Pilsner, not a Pilsner glass, but like a.
Like a pint glass?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, pint glass. Yeah, something tall-ish.
With a wide mouth.
Though. With a wider mouth, yeah. And so on the bottom, put in lemon basil, fresh lemon basil.
Or lemon verbena.
Or lemon verbena. And then get a stalk of lemongrass. With this lemongrass, we're going to use it both as a flavoring and as a stir. So take just like the bottom inch of it and give it a bend.
Yeah.
And on that part that you bend,
muddle
that with the herbs.
Yeah.
So give it just squash it with the end of a wooden spoon, or if you have an actual muddler, that'd be best. Then
some simple syrup.
A shot of simple syrup.
And then a shot of
aquavit.
And then two shots of
Cointreau.
And then.
So then fill it with, and it's give that a stir, fill it with ice.
Yeah, stir it again.
And then fill it with ice, and then top it with seltzer.
Yep.
And then use that lemongrass stock to stir it.
Yeah, yeah. And it's really good.
It's quite good. It's damn strange, but quite tasty.
Yeah.
That's the River's Edge.
River's Edge.
Ching ching. All right.
So, well, let's go down to the basement, even though we know we're going to do it already.
We had to dig through stacks and stacks and stacks because these ones are not easy to find.
Yes. So we're going to read. So he wrote one play.
His very first play is called
Back Home. It's a ghost play in one act.
Yep. And we've managed to locate a copy of that.
I got it from South Dakota State University. Yes. It took 6 weeks to get here.
Yes. But he has other plays that we're trying to get. So we're going to read as many of the plays as we can get our hands on. And they're all like one acts. So this will be...
Yeah, it's super short. This one play is like 19 pages.
19 pages long, yeah. So if anybody out there wants to read along with us, just drop us a line. Just go to our Blogspot webpage and drop us a line and let us know that you're interested. And we'll see. We'll tell you how to get a copy of these plays.
Yep. So far we got our hands on two, right?
So far. One's a Christmas play, so I don't think it's going to be very scary, but who knows?
It's like a ghost tale,
It could
right?
be a ghost tale, so we'll find out. But there's another one that I have a line on that I'm trying to get through interlibrary loan, so maybe we'll have as many as three, which would be, that'd be good. But even if it's just one or two, that will be...
And if you don't want to read it, that's fine.
Yeah, but just, yeah.
I'm hardly going to read it myself.
I'm going to read it that morning.
All right.
So I thought
we'd act it out in the basement.
We could do that. Yeah. We could do that. This is by far one of the dustiest and oldest of the volumes we've laid our hands on. It actually smells a little bit.
It does. It's brittle. The pages are like I said, they're like the Dead Sea Scrolls. They're so brittle.
You have to wear white gloves to turn the pages.
All right, well, we got that settled, so let's get out of the basement, because it's really nice out. All right.
All right.
Anything else about this book?
Not really. I'm glad we read them.
Yes, I am too. I am glad we read them.
They were well written. It's good that these books, they get resurrected apparently like every 30 years or so. So we're catching the wave in 2016.
And it really fits the Necronomipod Forbidden Book Group's
ethos.
Right, which is reading these things that have been long gone.
And yeah.
We haven't had a lot of those.
Not recently,
but it's nice to find something that's old that, okay.
Yeah, it's worth a read.
It's worth a read.
Yeah, so good. Good for us.
Good. Yeah, we are so good.
I'm patting you on the back.
I'm patting you on the back. All right, so I got nothing else.
You got nothing else. No. I got nothing else either.
I can smell dinner cooking from up here. So
yeah, it's probably getting pretty close, so yeah. We're going to go down and have some of it.
All right, so what do we do with this? Let's buy a bus ticket to Maine.
Yep.
And just let it and figure it out.
Yeah, just let it figure itself out.
Yeah. All right. Bye.
Bye.
I'm a going down, down, down to the river, and there ain't nobody gonna have to hold my hand. I'm a going down, down, down to the river, gonna bury my troubles in the river bottom sand. You said goodbye to me this morning and slowly walked out of my life. I don't know how I'll live without you. I only know I've gotta try. I'm a going down, down, down to the river, and there ain't nobody gonna have to hold my hand. I'm a going down, down, down to the river, gonna bury my troubles in the river bottom sand. Telephone has started ringing. Friends call to see if it is true. I don't know words to say it's over. I only know that I love you. I'm a going down, down, down to the river, and there ain't nobody gonna have to hold my hand. I'm a going down, down, down to the river, gonna bury my troubles in the river. Oh.